All right, good evening, everyone. Welcome. Nice to see everyone this evening. So my name is Tim Guile, one of the teachers here at Seattle Insight, and we'll start the evening with a 40-minute meditation, offer just a little bit of guidance, have a short break, then I'm going to offer a talk on concentration, the fundamentals of concentration. All right, ending the meditation with a poem called Still Life at Dusk, by Rosemary Wetola Traumer. It happens surprisingly fast, the way your shadow leaves you. All day you've been linked by the light, but now that darkness gathers the world in a great black tide. Your shadow joins the sea of all other shadows. If you stand here long enough, you too will forget your lines and merge with the tall grass and old trees, with the crows and the flooding river. All these pieces of the world that daylight has broken into objects of singular loneliness. It happens surprisingly fast, the drawing in of your shadow. And standing in the field, you become the field. And standing in the night, you are gathered by night, invisible. Birds sing to the memory of light. But then even those separate songs fade, tiny drops of ink in an infinite spilling. Still Life at Dawn, by Rosemary Wetola Traumer. All right, welcome back. It's nice to see all the conversations happening. All right, so we're finishing this month on concentration, and next month we move to the next link, which I believe is seeing things how they are, or something like that. It's kind of a clarity of seeing. And you start off with Carrie be leading the first session. But tonight, finishing with concentration. So tonight I wanted to do a talk around the fundamentals of concentration. This is maybe could have been better early in the series in the month here, but this is concentration is one of those things that all of us could really cultivating more of. Our society is really going against concentration with how quickly we're distracted. Our devices are constantly engaging us to look for the next click, and there's a sense of constant distraction, whether we're neurodivergent or just having this kind of ADHD we all swim in this culture. Now, concentration, as a word, you see in the suttas, it's often translated from the word samadhi. You can think of it as this kind of firmness of attention, this steadiness of attention, that our awareness or sense of knowing can land on something and stay there in a more or less unwavering way. And in that steadiness allows us to see more fully and completely what's being seen. So there's an aspect of it that we can go into very deep qualities that we actually lose contact with everything except that object. These are sometimes called the jhanas or the trance states. But concentration is also just a fundamental part of our mindfulness practice. It's an important thing to cultivate, to learn to have that steadiness. So tonight's talk is more on the kind of the lighter levels of concentration that we access in our daily practice, or we access on a shorter retreat. How do we cultivate that? How do we develop that? So I want to speak around three aspects. One is around how much effort is really needed around practice. Another one is around how do we work with the thinking mind? How do we learn to have a skillful relationship to thought? And finally, around kind of the attitude that allows concentration to arise. Now, concentration, that steadiness or samadhi factor, is on one spectrum of this field of meditative qualities. So we can have a quality that's really one-pointed, that's by nature more exclusive. We're letting go of everything else except that one object. The other side of the spectrum is more of an inclusive awareness, when we're aware of everything that's arising. Now, the tricky thing is that we can be aware of everything and still have a concentrated mind. There can be a quality of steadiness that's simply aware of what's arising and what's passing. It's an unwavering quality of awareness itself, right? And we can also go into this more focused depth of it. And there's a wide range of objects that we can focus on. You know, sometimes we focus on something like the breath because the breath is always with us. It's continuous. We don't have to believe anything special about the breath. Sometimes sound is a good, lovely object. Sometimes going through like a sweeping process, feeling one part of the body, then the next part, helps to cultivate that quality of awareness, of sustained attention. What we're looking for in an object is something that allows ourselves to start to calm down, to start to settle, to start to relax. Now, sometimes a teacher like myself might say, okay, turn toward your body, turn toward your breath. And yet we turn to our breath and we find it's the opposite effect. We don't want feeling ourselves settling. We're not feeling ourselves getting more calm and collected. We actually become a little bit more amped up. And maybe our heart rate changes. Sometimes that's because we have things which we haven't discharged in our system. It might be something like unresolved trauma, for example. It could be grief. It could be something I just haven't had a chance to feel. I really had a really hard day. I've been so busy keeping myself active and doing things that when I actually slow down, all that's not, that has not been felt starts to rise to the surface. So I say that because if a teacher says focus on your breath and you find that things are kind of going opposite of the calming side of things, it's actually very skillful and wise to shift your attention to something else. Something like sound, for example, that's external, or maybe focusing on a pleasant part of the body. Something that allows yourself to settle. So it doesn't really matter what object. You know, some traditions stare at a candle, some traditions say mantras. Metta meditation, for example, can be used to develop concentration. Now, concentration, just the very word we use in our culture sounds like, you know, I gotta concentrate, I gotta focus. And there's a sense of kind of bearing down and getting really kind of tense with that effort of concentration. So I want to speak about how much effort is really needed. And let's first start by talking about the Buddha's own journey when he started to meditate, when he started to actually seek enlightenment, seek something that was outside the terror of his mind of losing his youth, losing his health, losing his life, and that grief, to find something, that some part of the mind that was outside of that, to awaken from that terror of that. And being a fairly young man, he did some pretty austere and intense practices. So this is from one of the suttas when he's describing his early practice. This is before he became awakened. He said, this is what he says. He says, I thought, suppose with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrain, and crush my mind with my mind. Then, as a strong man might seize a weaker by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed my mind with my mind. Sweat ran from my armpits while I did so. Though tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness established, yet my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful effort. But such painful feelings arose in me, gained no power over my mind. So I don't know about you, but when I first started practice, I was in my mid-20s and wanted to practice really sincerely. So I really put a lot of effort into it. So this, if I just heard this, I was like, okay, I'm going to really strain to try to reel in this thinking mind and somehow connect with my breath. And I put a lot of effort into my practice. And I noticed that effort sometimes, I started to realize that was counterproductive. It was actually starting to rebound against me, being too harsh, too striving. I actually noticed this when I was on a retreat and I was trying to sit still in the midst of tight muscles and tight legs, sitting on the floor, cross-legged, and working really hard at relaxing with all that. And then I heard the bell call us back like that from a walking practice. And I heard the sound of the bell and I noticed that a fear arose right with that sound. The fear going back to practice and basically torturing myself. Okay. My teacher didn't tell me to sit through all this pain. That was just how I interpreted it. That's how my mind took this word concentration and striving and misinterpreted it to punishing the body. And then from that point, I realized, in that moment, I realized I'm doing something counterproductive. I'm going against why I'm practicing. If I'm trying to open my heart, if I'm trying to connect with myself deeply and others deeply, I can't do that by punishing myself, by denying myself. So as I realized that, then I started to have more compassion toward my body, my tight body, and to have more, just to shift the mind or shift the lip posture if I needed to. So this is, again, the early days of the Buddha's quest, and he realized, okay, this is not the right way. He actually went even more extreme, starving himself, till finally he realized he needed a balance of mind, a balance of attention. Another sutta where the Buddha is teaching this to a venerable Sona, who apparently used to be a musician, maybe a professional musician back then, playing some kind of stringed instrument, maybe like a lute or whatever it was that time in India. So he was practicing very diligently. So as Venerable Sona was meditating in seclusion, after doing walking meditation until the skin of her soles were split and bleeding, going to see the trend here? This train of thought arose in his awareness. Of the Blessed One's disciples who have aroused their persistence, I am one, but my mind is not released from the effluence through lack of clinging sustainment. He hasn't awoken. He hasn't felt his mind and heart open. Now, my family has enough wealth that it would be possible to enjoy wealth and make merit. Okay, so making merit, a lot of traditional Buddhist countries, merit is probably most Buddhist practice in the world. We're kind of strange in the West that we mostly meditate, but often it's much more of making merit, doing, being ethical, offering donations and dana to monasteries, and that's how that kind of, you can accumulate this metta so your next rebirth is more favorable. So what if I was going to just quit, disavow the training, return to the lower life, and enjoy wealth and make merit? So the Buddha is talking to him and says, okay, now remember, before you were a householder, you were skilled at playing the vina, which is some kind of guitar-like thing. And he said, yes. Now when your strings were too taut, was your instrument in tune and playable? No. And what do you think? When the strings of your instrument were too loose, was it in tune and playable? No. Right? So when they were in tune, they were too taut, no loose, and turned just right, were you able to make music? And of course, this person realized that. And the metaphor, of course, is our practice and our effort. We can sometimes practice so much effort that it's counterproductive, like an instrument is sharp. It's not going to make good music. On the other hand, if we're more slack, if we're not having enough effort, we also can't make music. And this is where concentration is this really interesting balance of how do we find that right effort, that right balance. And I think for most of us, we kind of know ourselves. We know which side of the spectrum do we come on. Do we tend to be some of the people who tend to always strive and always work hard and push ourselves? Okay, so you're probably too tight. If you're more on the sense of, okay, I'm just going to, maybe tomorrow I'll meditate. I want to do something else today. There's kind of that more laissez-faire, kind of relaxed attitude, that kind of not really very disciplined, then maybe your strings are too loose, right? So how to find that right balance is part of what we need to find as meditators. Classic example is broccoli, believe it or not. If you want to eat broccoli and you had a fork, how much effort would you need to be able to eat a piece of broccoli, right? So if you're using too much effort, you might shatter the plate, you might knock the broccoli over the place, you might stab yourself in the face, right? Because it's too tight, right? If you have the right amount of effort, you have to have enough effort to actually connect with the broccoli and to find where your mouth is, right? But that's not that much effort. For most of us, even babies, they can still kind of slam the food in there somehow. My daughter used to take a spoonful of food and then turn it over so this the concave side was down and lick the top. Took her a while to figure that one out. So how much effort do we need? And this is something that it really kind of confronts our natural conditioning as human beings, you know, how we were raised, how we were parented, our experiences, our training through school, or different professional training. All those tend to make us, that tends to come into how we meditate. We don't meditate kind of in a clean slate. We come with a lot of baggage. Sometimes it's really helpful, and sometimes it gets in our way. Probably eventually it all gets in our way. But initially, it may help us to kind of get some purchase on the whole path. Now, sometimes when we're practicing, and we just say I pick an object of attention, and that object may be mismatched to where my mind is, where my energy is, where the system of mind of the heart is in that moment. It's not so helpful to get frustrated and keep kind of plowing through when it just isn't working. Often what I like to do is when I'm trying to meditate and I find that my attention is just not landing at it, I like to shift a little bit, maybe open my eyes, take in the surroundings, open to sound, for example, to something to broaden the attention, or maybe even shift the attention, like the example of trauma, to not to try to push ourselves through, but find something we can start to settle with. We can play with that spectrum of inclusivity versus exclusivity. Sometimes we try to be too exclusive, too narrow in our focus, and we get too tight in the midst of that. So then instead, choosing to be a little bit broader with it, just relaxing, opening to sound, sensations, breath, letting the attention become more natural. That's also concentration. That's also steadiness. What perhaps isn't so helpful, if we're like meditating and it's like, okay, I'm not really connecting with the breath, or maybe I'll focus on sound. Oh, that's kind of boring. Maybe I'll focus on thoughts. You know, and then I start to get lost in thoughts. So if you're finding yourself kind of flitting from one thing to another, like a bird going from one branch to another, you want to find one or two and then try to settle through that. Because for most of us, when we start to practice, it's not like it's a linear process of from low concentration to deep concentration, or maybe the other way around. So as you go from a deeper concentration, it's usually lots of ups and downs. So we can choose to focus on something, our minds get distracted. Learning to persevere through that starts to build the concentration, that muscle of steadiness, of attention. So working, one of the things that tends to get in our way of concentration is our relationship to thought and thinking. You know, we really have a lot of allure. Thought's very alluring to us. It's very enticing to us. We can think wonderful things. We can think horrible things. We can plan. We can worry. We can reminisce. We can elaborate upon this moment. We can have all these Dharma thoughts. But all those take us a little bit away, or sometimes quite a bit away, from this present moment, from what's actually happening right here and right now. Like the quote about James Joyce's Mr. Duffy from Dubliners, that he lived a short distance from his body. Right. So sometimes we're a little bit removed from that. Mindfulness, and especially concentration, is about unification, bringing everything together. So we're trying to have one point of focus and our mind keeps thinking. Our mind keeps pulling us into something else. Now this is really important territory to be conscious of. How do we meet the thinking mind? Because in just what I said, that thinking mind tends to get in the way of concentration. Many of us are going to think, okay, thought is a problem. I need to get rid of thought. I need to fight the fact that I'm thinking and to judge the fact that I'm thinking. And we don't want to be in opposition with the thinking mind. We don't want to be in opposition with the mind that's engaged in that way. Because remember I said concentration is about this unification. If we divide one part of our souls against another, that's the opposite of unification. That's creating a sense of division. So it's not so helpful to have critical thoughts and be uptight about the fact that you're thinking. Because guess what's doing that? Is more thoughts. Right? It's like you're trying to use thoughts to get rid of thoughts. it doesn't work so well. I like this analogy of sitting in a calm pool, and we have a ripple or a pebble drops, and there's all these ripples. Let's see, that ripple represents thoughts, right? The calmness represents our awareness. So if I had that a ripple go through me or go through the pond, and I really did not like it, and I use my hands to try to stop the ripple, what happens? You know, I make more and more ripples, right? But if I just allow the ripples to naturally subside, that's more analogous to what we try to do with practice. So not judging the fact that the mind's thinking. That's just what it does. But at the same time, we also need a certain clarity or firmness of intention not to get lost in thought. One of the things I think is helpful and counterintuitive is to actually sincerely befriend the thinking mind, to actually have a kind relationship to thinking mind, and yet, you know, a firm one, a clarity of purpose with that. I actually often suggest to students when they're really caught in these judgmental patterns and the thinking mind, and they're really struggling with a part of themselves, and they're trying to get over their part of themselves, if they could just get rid of this judgmental part, this worry part, this anxious part, this part that keeps trying to plan, if I can just get rid of that, then I'll finally be able to meditate. Often I suggest that they turn toward that part, metaphorically or, you know, literally, and actually bow to it, actually thank it for how good of a job that it's doing. That mind, you're really, really good at thinking. You're really good at solving this problem. You're good at creating problems to solve, which really aren't even here, you know? And so then that allows you to shift from this aversive, adversarial relationship to thinking to one of a friendliness. And you're more in charge at that point. The wise part of you is aware, is in charge. It's like, okay, instead of struggling with a thinking mind, it's more like, thank you for thinking. And right now, I'm cultivating this connection with the breath, with sound, with the body. Now, often when we're trying to develop concentration and we're struggling with it, one of the hindrances or multiple hindrances are present. They're arising and they're kind of throwing us off our practice. We have trouble settling, concentrating, so they're often present in one way or another. Just very generally, we can say there's either the excess energy, too much energy, or not enough energy. Right, so if there's too much energy, it tends to take the form of restlessness. You know, or physically you can't sit still, mentally I just keep proliferating. There's often a quality of aversion or craving caught in it. Like if you're a craving type, like I tend to be, sometimes my mind just gets obsessed with something. It just can't let it down. It just keeps chewing on it, thinking about it. Right, there's a real energy with that. There's an unrest in the body and the mind. When I'm in a more aversive type, I can be just thinking about all the things I don't like about this situation, this person, about myself. And inwardly, there's a lot of turbulence. Physically, there's a lot of turbulence. Or perhaps there's a quality of not enough energy. So we're getting sleepy or dull. We're just kind of falling asleep, like the blinds are coming over our eyes. We can't quite stay connected and focused to this present moment. So as those things arise, this is part of practice. How do I meet that? How do I work with that? And what's not so helpful is to be upset with the fact that the hindrance is here. Because that's just giving ourselves another hindrance, right? We're just multiplying the problem. Remember the night of the Buddha? You know that story when he's awakening, trying to awaken, and he says, okay, finally, I think I understand what I need to do or not do. And he has this deep commitment to practice. And Mara, this personification of delusion, is trying to shake him off his seat, trying to scare him, trying to intimidate him, trying to seduce him through all the hindrances. And the Buddha just keeps on practicing. It's like this just arises and it flushes off, sloughs off him like this, like water off this duck's back. And that's how concentration starts to develop, when we start to practice despite the hindrances, despite the mind coming this way and that way. So some ways to work with the thinking mind. There's two ways I want to touch upon tonight. One is, actually, these are both similar in this way, that we first have to step back to observe the fact that we're thinking, to be aware of the fact that we're thinking. Something that gives us a little perspective on it. Sometimes we use a noting technique. This is from the Mahasi technique, or style of practice, one of the meditation masters in, back in the old country, if you will. And they learned, what you learn to do is to note every experience. You know, breathing in, breathing out, touching a cup, stepping. So everything you're doing, you're basically saying it into yourself quietly or silently. So what this does is it times your attention and your verbiage and your mental function to what's actually happening right here and right now. It's kind of giving you, I think of it as giving your mind something to do. And I found this technique really helpful, especially early in my practice, to instead of my mind just being so lost in thought and being so distracted and frustrated, I would just note breathing in and breathing out. And that actually gave me something to focus on. I knew when I was breathing in, and I could say that, and when I was breathing out, I could say that. And I noticed when I got sleepy or kind of checked out, I would say breathing in when I was actually breathing out, and so then I would wake up and bring a little bit more energy to it. A teacher I learned from early on actually suggested doing that noting out loud. Right, so we couldn't really do it in a group setting, but if you're by yourself and you want to play with it, just play with breathing in, breathing out, literally out loud saying it. And then as your attention starts to settle, you can back off that to just silent noting and eventually just back off to no sound at all. He described it as like a car with different gears. Being stuck in the mud, it's like four-wheel drive, that's noting out loud. Getting onto the dirt road, that's first gear, maybe silent noting. Get on the freeway, maybe just drop the noting. Right? So it's an interesting and helpful technique to play with. But what it does is allows us to step back and know that we're having this experience, to know that we're here. Right? So we can use, okay, thoughts going around, I'm going to just focus on this breath, this sound, this sensation. You can also work with thought itself a little more directly. One is just to sometimes step back enough to notice, is this a pleasant thought, a unpleasant thought, or a neutral thought? Usually the first two are the ones that are going to be kind of sticky, right? Just, okay, this is a pleasant thought of fantasy, of anticipation. That lets me step back and actually observe it just a little bit. So it's not, I'm not so caught by it. It's unpleasant the same way. I want to share another thing that I came up with in relationship to this. And I haven't actually ever taught this to anybody, so let's see how you like it. And this is when we have our minds really busy. We're thinking all the time. We're trying to meditate, and our mind's just going all over the place. Right? Anyone ever have that happen? Yeah. Yeah? Anyone not have it happen? Now, awareness, we could say, let's say consciousness itself can be in different, let's say it's different levels or stages. So the first stage, let's say, is that we're just in the middle of those thoughts. We don't realize that we're not the thoughts. We're living the thoughts. We're experiencing thoughts. And sometimes this could be really self-destructive and painful. Like, okay, I'm such a terrible person. Or we live a story like you are such a fill-in-the-blank person. And then we're relating to life through our thoughts. There's no sense of perspective that the thoughts are nothing other than thought. We think of them as reality, right? Do you get a sense of that? There's a kind of like complete enmeshment in the thinking process, right? So we're in that stage. That's really difficult. Now we start to meditate and we start to become aware of our thoughts. We become aware of how much our thoughts are going this way and that way. And I love to point this out to when a student's complaining or is, you know, distressed, because like my mind just has not stopped thinking. It's just going all over the place. I can feel the breath a little bit, but it's all over the place. And I like to point out that they're more aware than they would have been. That actually they're aware of how much they're thinking. There's a part of them that's actually observing this experience, Right? And that part, the only trick is, how do we allow that part to become more to the foreground, the quality of observation? Right? So the kind of the pathway of that is, we start to become aware of the fact that we're thinking, and usually we're judging the fact we're thinking, right? We're frustrated. I've been meditating for 2 weeks. Why is my mind still so busy? I've been meditating for 40 years. Why is my mind so busy? You know, and there's this secondary judgment that kind of comes down, right? There's a frustration. So we're seeing clearly, but we're adding judgment to it. This is a little bit like if we're playing in the surf, right? So we're in the ocean and we're right where the waves are crashing down. We can see the wave coming, but we're getting crashed and tumbled down, and we get up, we get hit by another wave, right? Now, if you go a little deeper into the ocean, then the waves aren't crashing. They're just rising up and they're falling down. We can actually enjoy that being lifted up and that falling down without getting battered all over the place. And this is kind of that third level, when we actually start to become aware that we're thinking, okay, I'm aware that thought is here. And you kind of retreat, or not so much retreat, but you direct your energy to that part that's aware that you're thinking. Okay, that's not so concerned with the content of the thought, but just knows that there's thinking. Now, that part itself, ask, what else is it aware of in this moment? What else is present? Because that part is also able to equally access the sound outside, to access a breeze going across your arm, to feel the breath, right? And what you've done is, you've gone from being immersed in thought, enmeshed in thought, to being aware of thought but judging the fact you're thinking, to noticing the part that's aware itself, that's present and connected, and letting that part actually connect with something outside of thought. What else is here? What else is present in this moment? So we're not getting rid of thought. We're not negating it. We're just shifting to something else, some other attention. And the amount of effort that takes is very light, actually. Often I teach this, I like to teach this on the fifth day or fourth day of a meditation, of a residential retreat, because we've practiced enough, we've struggled with our thoughts, we're starting to get some stability. But I'll show it to you right now if you like. If you hold up one of your hands and just look at your hand and the foreground, right? Notice how that sense of foreground is. Now let your gaze shift to whatever is in the background, what's behind the hand, right? And then go back to the foreground and then to the background. And I do that a few more times, but noticing how much effort it takes to shift from foreground to background. Is that like lifting a 50-pound bag of gravel? You know, it's not much effort at all. It's actually more of intentionality. Because both are here. Right? Let's say thought is this hand in the front of your face, but there's also the background of the wall and the people behind the hand. And so both are present. But we see thought come up and we're just struggling with it. But all we have to do is just let our attention shift to what's behind us. So play with that a little bit. This is a lovely thing to do out in nature, you know, practicing with all the nature around you. You're feeling your body, feeling the breath, and let's say thought starts to intrude, or maybe the mind's just really restless, really busy, caught with aversion. Maybe it could be some very significant content in your life. Notice how you can be aware of the fact of thinking itself, right? You're aware that the mind is thinking. And that part that's aware of thinking is also aware of other things around you. And just that, like that foreground, background, let your attention shift to that. So play with that. Let me know how that goes. So thinking, working with thinking and concentration, it does require a certain firmness of attention, firmness around the mind. Because the mind, sometimes we focus so much on being open to what's here and allowing things to be how it is. And sometimes the thinking mind just kind of hijacks the whole thing. That we're just kind of lost in daydreams and thoughts. And sometimes that can feel really pleasant, right? I'm just kind of drifting along, thinking about this and that, kind of aware of the breath, but not very much. So the firmness of mind is to realize, okay, actually right now I'm trying to really connect with this present moment's experience through the body, through sound, through the breath. The trick is not to do it with too much tension, to not do it with self-hatred or self-restriction, but much more of a relaxed quality. So this brings me to my last section, is around the attitude of how do we cultivate attention. And I use this word intentionally to cultivate versus attainment. Because attainment of concentration, sometimes we read about the jhanas and we think, okay, I want to attain that jhana, I want to get to that jhana, I want to work and strive to get it, and once I get it, then I, like a bunch of merit badges, then I get to be an Eagle Scout at the end or a Gold Scout. But yet, it's not so much about attainment, it's much more of this unification of the mind and body. So think of it more of a cultivation. Just like I was cultivating a relationship or friendship, I was cultivating a plant to grow, it has its own timing. It has its own rate of growth. We can't force it to come out faster than it's ready. You know, we have to allow it to grow. You know, like Joseph talked about when he was a kid, Joseph Goldstein, had a science kit where there was growing carrots or something, and he kept pulling them up to see if they were growing. Right? Instead of letting them grow at their own pace, their own timing. And so that's the first thing, is having an intention to develop this more steady mind. Just try to be a little bit more steady. Don't try to feel like I have to be perfect at it. Just a little bit more steady, a little bit more connected. Because the mind actually at some point prefers to be collected, prefers to be present. And this is an interesting switching point in our lives, in our meditative journey. Because for a long time, you know, we're so alert, or we have so much connection and desire for the thinking mind. It's so entertaining, but it's also so distressing. And our minds are constantly thinking. But at some point, through accumulation of insight and through practice, something shifts that our minds actually prefer to be steady, to be quiet, to be collected. Right? So we can't force that, right? You can't force that to happen, but you can cultivate that. And the way to cultivate it is through how we've been talking about how to practice with it, with a sense of clarity, but also kindness, a sense of openness, befriending the thinking mind. So just like cultivation, you know, sometimes there's the weeding the plants, the getting the plants that aren't desired. So this is more like the form of how do you attend to the hindrances in a skillful way? Through compassion, bringing a quality of compassion to this experience. Finally, receiving versus doing. I remember my very first retreat at Cloud Mountain. I was sitting around chatting with people at the end, and I was talking about how I was really focusing on putting my attention on my breath. And the person I was talking to, I forget his name, but he'd been practicing for like 20 years. I've been practicing for like 3 months. And he said, well, actually, what I do is I work on receiving the breath, letting the breath come to me. And I was like, oh, that's completely different from what I was doing. I was spending all my time trying to put my attention on my breath versus letting the breath come to me. If you have the sense of letting the breath come to you or whatever your object is, that helps bring this quality of relaxation, of ease, of joy and happiness, all the precursors we've talked about this year for concentration to arise. So receiving this breath, letting it come to you, letting it be known that way. And having a wordless curiosity. What is this? What is this experience like? And it's actually been quite enjoyable when the mind becomes concentrated, becomes steady, you're able to experience this breath and all the nuances. You can experience the sound or the sensation. It's a bit like this poem by Linda Paston that I'll end with, called Imaginary Conversation. You tell me to live each day as if it were my last. This in the kitchen where before coffee I complained of the day ahead. That obstacle race of minutes and hours, grocery stores and doctors. But why the last, I ask? Why not live each day as if it were the first? All raw astonishment. Eve rubbing her eyes awake that first morning, the sun coming up, like an ingenue in the east. You grind the coffee with the small roar of a mind trying to clear itself. I set the table, glance out the window where dew has baptized every living surface. All right, can we just sit quietly for a moment or two, let those words settle? Receiving this moment, just how it is, body, breath. Thank you for your kind attention. We have a space now for any questions or sharing you might have. Go ahead, Kathy.
I've taken a few notes here, and I really like the variety of approaches here. This is very practical, and we'll see how it goes. But mainly I was just feeling that your whole talk was so, just thank you, Tim. It was so eloquent.
Well, thank you. So all the things that, you know, that you heard, and pick one that you resonated with and work with it for a while. And then, you know, you can come back and pick another one after a while. And just kind of let yourself, because it's really, there's a lot of ways to work with concentration, because our minds are lost in different ways. You know, that's one of the benefits of a daily practice, is you get to see and develop the capacity to meet yourself in lots of situations and conditions. Sometimes you're sleepy, sometimes you're restless, sometimes you're racked with grief, with worry, with anxiety. But if you practice each day, it's like you're learning how, oh, I can meet myself in this way. Right, and each of those ways, sometimes we need to meet it in a different concentration, needs to be developed or cultivated in this way. Maybe another way cultivates this way. So find pick one that resonates and practice with it a while, and then practice another one after a while, and that way you start to develop this repertoire of how to meet concentration. And most importantly, we start to develop this sense of when our attention is steady, when it's concentrated. And if we can avoid the pitfall of judging ourselves for not being concentrated, and more learn, okay, see as a sense of learning, how can I balance my attention? How can I work with the mind just how it is? Maybe I need to broaden my attention. Maybe I need to focus my attention. Maybe I need to relax. Maybe I need to have a little more firmness around the mind that wants to daydream my next vacation. All right, thank you, Kathy. Yes, up front.
Hi, thank you so much for the talk. At some point you mentioned that we could use loving kindness as a way to develop concentration. I was wondering if you could speak a bit more about that.
Sure.
Concentration on its own feels like, I don't know, a little empty. I feel like it must be, to me, it feels like if I'm trying to meditate and I'm trying to be peaceful, that I guess kind of makes sense, or I guess loving kindness, but I'm just trying to understand how it, like, concentration on its own seems to be like a, yeah, like you were describing, too much, a lot of effort, doesn't really help.
Yeah.
Should it be directed towards something, or... Yeah, I guess.
Sure.
Great question.
Yes, so there are a few pieces, I think, with your question that I want to touch upon. So let's start with just the sense of concentration, feeling kind of empty, or kind of just feel like too much effort, or too dry, or maybe too like will driven or head driven. Okay, I got to concentrate, you know, that kind of energy that loads up. And it's really interesting just to notice, step back and notice, oh, I think I have to concentrate, and what loads up. It's like you turn on your device and you hit an app. you've hit the striving app without even realizing it. So it's running in the background, but it's kind of shaping everything that you're doing. So you can step back and notice. So I'm going to talk about it in a lot of ways for a second. So one is just noticing when that strivingness comes up. And there's a wisdom in knowing, okay, that has a limited value. It's maybe not what I'm really wanting. Right? So one way to work with it is to simply shift to, or to cultivate a quality of kindness in the meditation itself, in the way that you're focusing. Here's, you know, one teacher from a different tradition talked about take a picture of yourself and cut off the head of your head and just picture yourself walking around without a head. Not in a gruesome way, but you know, just in a not in a gruesome way, but in just like you're actually shifting to the heart is what's feeling. The heart's what's meditating. The heart's what's feeling this breath and this sound. So I would encourage you to play with that too. Yeah, because sometimes we think about where the central part of the meditation is, like it's here, you know, it's in my mind. But the whole body has that natural quality of softness and allowance. Yeah, and hold and opening. One piece to be aware of is that sometimes we go into our minds to meditate or use our minds as a central point because of how we've trained or our natural predisposition. And sometimes because we're trying to avoid feeling what's down here, right? It's like, oh, if I go into my body, I have to feel all that stuff I've not been trying to feel. So then, how can I feel in a more gradual way? Now back to your question around metta, and as an object of attention, of cultivating concentration. So if you look at the time of the Buddha, he taught about metta was much more of this relational, this changing of your attitude of how you relate to experience. Metta, they didn't have the phrases. They just said offering metta in this forward direction or this sideways direction. This loving kindness, the metta itself. So it's almost a wordless quality. It wasn't until, I don't know how many years later, maybe 300, 500, 600 years later, there's a commentary called the Visuddhimagga, and that's where we see this concentration and metta being linked, right? Because if you use a phrase like, may I be safe and protected, may I be peaceful, and I keep saying that over and over again, that's going to start to develop concentration. It gives me something to focus on. So you can play with that too. You know, play with that quality of just bringing your attention just to that one phrase, or maybe the feeling of kindness, of well-wishing, or the object of that. That's a few things there to play with. Yeah. Because it's a great question, because it's like, how do I work with kind of the dryness or the aloofness of concentration, the striving concentration. Part of that is how do I work with the conditioning of my mind and body, how I'm conditioned to strive. And often we strive because we want to be better, or we want to avoid pain, or we want to earn love or succeed or something. And all that starts to fall away as we practice, because we realize we're not actually attaining anything. We're actually uncovering what's already here. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah. Yeah, thank you for your question. All right, so let's go to online Anastasia.
Hi. Yeah, thank you. I think maybe similar to that, when you said receiving the breath,
yeah,
I had a totally different feeling than kind of almost chasing the breath, grasping for the breath. Yeah. And the feeling is, one is very parched, I guess. The other feeling, the receiving, is very full. And that safety that you were talking about, it just naturally occurs. Because I find like my mind is, you know, always trying to figure everything out. Like as though that's gonna keep me safe. That's gonna keep other people safe. That's gonna solve the problems. But that receiving the breath is about gratitude too. It's about like really appreciating being here and really appreciating everyone and everything that is here. So thank you very much for that.
You're very welcome. Yeah, I'm glad that that resonated. It was a powerful thing to for me to hear that. Okay, receive the breath, and because when, like you said, like when I'm going out to find the breath, another piece is like I'm really involved. I'm really doing. You know, my sense of me is really engaged. Or receiving, there's I can't really be. I'm just receiving. It kind of allows that sense of self to quiet down. Allows the heart to start to open. And then meditation becomes a place of ease, a place of connection, which is ultimately what it's designed to do.
I was just going to say that, connection. That's what, yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for sharing that, Anastasia. All right, we'll go back and forth here in online in the room. So let's go to in the room, and then we'll come back to Dan in a moment.
Thank you for your talk. Can you help tease out the distinctions and the interlinkages between awareness, attention, and concentration as it relates to meditation?
Okay, between awareness, attention, and concentration. So it depends on how, I mean, for myself, it depends how I use it, how I mean it different ways. Like my teacher, Rodney Smith, who was the founding teacher of Seattle Insight, he would use awareness and meditation or mindfulness in a really different way as two different, you know, separate connections. So in terms of how I'm using it, so let's say attention and attention. I remember I was teaching an intro class and I was saying attention. I thought I sort of was saying tension. It's like, no, not tension. So attention. So attention is like that quality of knowing, that quality of awareness. And that's one way you can look at aware of meditation is like the art of attention. How do we actually choose to focus on something, you know, consciously? How do we actually cultivate a quality of seeing in a particular way, not a way that's, because attention can have a quality of seeing in judgmental or trying to fix or solve, evaluate, compare, or it can also have this more neutral, welcoming quality. So I use attention as just kind of this general quality. Concentration is more of this kind of narrowing down or this more of the steadiness quality of it. So like you can have attention that's not very steady. You can have attention that's more steady. So if it's more steady, it has a concentration element with it. Then awareness, I would say I tend to use that more in, again, more from that kind of the evolved quality of attention. Awareness is kind of this thing that's outside of me that's simply knowing this experience. That's more how Rodney would use it. He would tend to talk about mindfulness is something that I'm choosing to do, while awareness is more of what's outside of me, but yet is within me, if that makes sense. So it's like awareness is the capacity to know, to be present without the sense of me as a part of that. Well, the spotlight versus floodlight, that's kind of that capacity of concentration, also mindfulness, whether I can focus in or I can also be really broad. One way to look at it, especially with concentration, is just how distracted is the attention versus how united or connected, like we're talking with Anastasia. How much am I really steady with this? So I can do that in a pinpoint, like a flashlight. Just focusing on this one part of you, like seeing your shirt or something. Or I could be like the light, the awareness or attention can be like the light in the room that's simply receiving everything all at once. And just as a teacher or as a human being, I tend to be kind of approximate with my words. I tend to like, you know, use them pretty broadly. I'm not like, this is what this means, this is what this means. So, other teachers may be much more precise with their language, so I'm a little more sloppy or inclusive. That gives me more freedom to contradict myself, maybe. I don't know. All right, does that help? Yeah, thanks for the question. Okay, go ahead, Dan.
I realized that I continue to get go back and forth in my mind between trying to concentrate. And immediately my mind says, what am I going to use this for? And maybe somebody earlier who was saying that concentration felt, I don't know if it was empty or so, help me a little bit with, and maybe it's just I just need to practice more to understand that concentration just by itself is valuable. But like immediately I'm thinking, I'm going to read a book. Concentration means how can I pay attention to the book for half an hour? And even in doing this practice with you tonight, Tim, my mind was immediately going toward, I have to bring it back from, well, what am I going to do with this? I'm concentrating on what? What am I going to do with this? So in any event, I don't know if that's unusual or maybe I just need to just see concentration as its own value for now, not as a solution or a tool to be used for some other problem.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting question. Yeah, it's a fine question, a good question. Like if I was a more traditional teacher, I'd say, yeah, just trust me and do it. Just keep
I'm good
going.
With that.
And there's some value in that because, you know, we can, but I can also appreciate, you know, like you're investing a lot of time and energy into this. You know, like we talked about, I think, you know, you and I talked a little bit after class, you know, just like, okay, what's, you know, what's the kind of the purpose of practice? So part of it is like we have to kind of believe, you know, that this practice is actually going to give me something that I need or want. That's, you know, that's a valid thing, you know. And for many of us, sometimes it's like it's really obvious what the practice is. You know, I can really have a sense of that. I'm really moving toward that. I really want that. And often those people realize what they really want from that early perspective. It really transforms as time goes on. But this is what I'm trying to say to you, just like that example of reading the book and how you have to focus on that book. So that's a function of concentration to be able to stay with that book for half an hour. The book that you're trying to read is your inner experience. You're trying to read the inner experience of your breath and your body, and you're trying to learn a new language. You're trying to learn a new dialect and a whole new logic. And it's outside of maybe what you've been trained in. And with all your professional training and all these other things, it's a different language that you're opening to. And so it does take some concentration to be able to let that actually be able to understand the words.
That was beautiful. I think I got it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good, you're welcome. All right, there's someone else online, but they dropped their hand. Okay, go ahead, Sherry.
Hi, thank you. I realize as I hear you answering people's questions that I am setting myself up for a contrast at the very least. I could say, you know, I'm hurrying to make sure that I get to Sims on time. I'm worrying, am I going to have time in the morning to sit or time in the afternoon to sit? I'm scrolling through my calendar to put time in my calendar to make sure that I sit. And then I get to sit like, okay, I'm sitting now. Oh, you know, and the quality of receptivity that you're talking about also makes me think of like having a bit of a sense of humor. And just shit happens kind of attitude about things so that the pressure on my own attention is less forceful, so anyway, I just wanted to share that because it was something that came to mind as you were talking.
Yeah, beautiful. And that's one thing I love about the practice is it's really about, it teaches us how to, like I was talking with Dan about, is learning to read this inner book, this inner narrative. And if we're really reading it, eventually we kind of see, oh, wow, this pattern of kind of that tension of writing a schedule and fit it in, you start to feel, okay, maybe that's not as helpful as I want it to be, or I want to maybe have something else. And just how you, so the seeing of that and then the intention to be maybe more receptive. And that's, it's like what I'm trying to say is that if we pay attention, our life will show us exactly the path. You know, show us, okay, if we trust what we're seeing, if we learn to not trust our normal narrative and our normal neuroses, but actually trust what we're actually seeing is like, okay, there's wisdom that comes out. It's like, okay, yeah, this way I'm practicing, maybe there's some ways to play with it. So it's actually of, and humor, I think, is a great thing. If we can laugh at ourselves and laugh at what the mind does, it, you know, loses so much of its strength and power. Yeah, not taking it so personally. Yeah,
thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. All right. Yes.
So earlier when you spoke of receptivity and accepting an experience or a thought or concentration, it brought up a question that's been on my mind for about 30 years. And I'm a very slow question asker, so it's taken me a long time. But when you have those experiences that mean a lot to you, that maybe we want to hold on to or relive, that when they're happening to you, it's easy enough to start to think about the experience and try to like intellectualize about it. And I feel like when you said the word accepting the experience, it made it a lot easier for me to understand how that experience unfolded, where something happened and I had an experience and I wanted to understand it better. And as I started to, the experience itself started to fade. And then as I let go of the wanting, it came back again.
That's right.
So is there an experience for you that kind of initially kind of solidified this understanding for you?
This understanding of receiving or understanding of just how to live life?
Receiving.
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, there's probably so many I could point to or talk about. Let me just comment on your point for a second, in that sense of when we're thinking through things or kind of intellectualizing it, there's kind of an insulation between us and experience. When we're really receiving it, then we're really allowing ourselves to fully live that. And I think there's so many things I could point to in any particular arena, relationships, nature, activities. What's your resonance there?
Your own experience of your own health.
Own health.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard for me to pinpoint like the first time or the most, but I can just do it like right now. It's like when there's a sense of allowing the body be just how it is. Because usually there's a sense of the body should look this way or not that way, and there's this judgment or this. When I actually allow myself to simply relax into it, to actually sense it just how it is, and there's that sense of separation falls away, there's this direct connection. And there's a sense of health, there's a sense of joy and connection in that meeting. And that becomes actually, it just becomes almost second nature. It becomes actually more our true nature is to seek that, to find that. And when I'm disconnected, yeah, there's a dissonance, there's a struggle with that, there's a desire to get back to it. And sometimes, Sherry was talking about, you know, life is really busy and there's all this momentum going on. And yet, to a couple moments of just of pausing, just opening to the sky, opening to the trees around me, then that comes right back. So I'm not know if I'm quite getting at your question, but does that help?
It almost perfectly reflects another experience.
Yeah, good. Thank you for sharing that. All right, so let's go to Joseph. Yeah, go ahead, Joseph.
Hello. Hi, Tim. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. Thanks for the talk tonight. I think this past week or two, I've been struggling with doubt, I think. Doubt about the path. I guess I've been reading some of the Buddha's like words, and sometimes the things he says are so radical that, you know, it's not my experience. Like there are times where, you know, I feel like the practice or like my dedication to the practice is bearing fruits, but then other times, you know, the teaching seems so radical and so strong that it's hard to kind of see myself, you know, ever getting to that point or kind of seeing the point of it all. And I guess I'm wondering if like faith in the path or anything like that is certain to grow, I suppose, or if I should take it just upon, you know, keep trying it out. Hmm. But I just wanted to hear what you had to say about that.
Sure. Yeah, one of the downsides of like reading the suttas and reading about the Buddha is they were kind of getting the best of, you know, because remember the Buddha's, there was no writing, you know, nothing was written down. There's no recorder, there's no, you know, tapes or anything like that for the first 300 years after the Buddha died. You know, so basically people were remembering what he had taught. And then there was groups coming together and saying, okay, this is what we want to say the Buddha said. You know, some of it was really accurate, but some of it, you know, I'm sure there's a little bit of kind of giving the best front for, you know, face forward. And sometimes if we relate to the Buddha as this person, this being that's so far evolved and so beyond us, faith can turn to discouragement, right? There's a sense of, how can I measure up to that? Now, what you've probably come across the line when the Buddha said, I would not ask you to do it if it wasn't possible for you to do it. You know, so there's some of those pieces really letting those come forth. Okay, how can I, this is possible. He's not saying this is beyond the ordinary person's experience or capacity. This is your birthright. And sometimes reinterpreting, you know, finding, you know, Buddhism has such a rich history of commentary and different teachers adding their voice, to find a voice that maybe is a little bit more modern that you can actually connect with or resonate with, you know, and realize that there's these gateways into what awakening really means or what that openness really means. And also to realize that sometimes doubt is a sign of your practice deepening too. Often we start practice, there's this enthusiasm, this brightness, but then we start to practice and realize, well, this is kind of, there's a lot of stuff here. It's kind of a heavy lift. But yet if you go through that, there's a way that the practice starts to really show itself. So I guess what I would say is kind of set your sights lower initially. Set your sights on something that's, okay, maybe I can be a little bit more present. Maybe I can work with being a little less judgmental. Maybe I can just work with connecting with nature, connecting with myself, and see if that isn't a gateway to the deep parts, you know, over time. Because that's part of the nature of, if we are really connected to the Dharma, it's like this connected fabric that we touch one part of it, eventually we touch the deeper parts of it. But it's finding what that engagement is, that entry point is for you. And yeah, you may, you know, especially if doubt's really prevalent, talking to a teacher can be really helpful because it's hard to kind of unpack exactly the nature of your doubt that's coming up. And sometimes the doubt comes up because the way we're practicing needs a little tweakage. Maybe the methods, the techniques need to be adjusted. Maybe the attitude. Maybe there's just some reassurance. That's, yeah, this is normal. And you're on the right path. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thanks, Tim.
Yeah, so either if you go to our website, Seattle Insight, under teachers, there's all the teachers have contact information. So you can reach out to see if they have space or time to do like individual practice meeting. That can be really helpful. Or you can come up after class or something if you come in person and chat for a little bit. All those things are fine with for all our teachers.
Sure. Thank you, Tim.
Thank
you. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. All right. Maybe one more if there's anyone. Yes. Okay, we do two more.
Hey, Tim. Earlier in the talk, you spoke about when a certain object is causing any form of strain or distress or stress or anything like that, it's skillful to move to another object. I've kind of mentioned in the past about how I have sort of a proclivity towards choiceless awareness rather than a single object. And part of that is because it's just in general sort of difficult for me to maintain focus on a singular object to the exclusivity of the other objects. And the reason I bring that up is because along the lines of what you were talking about, the breath is particularly difficult for me because it's when I start to notice the breath, it starts to sort of switch into something that it feels like I'm doing. And I've practiced with noting about receiving before, and that helps temporarily, but it tends to always kind of shift back towards I'm doing the breathing. And then in doing the breathing, that's causing this anxiety because it's not in the same natural rhythm that my body would just breathe in normally. I was just wondering if you could speak to any like sort of techniques to kind of even that out. Like, should I be just going as far as noting, receiving with each in-breath, or are there some sort of other techniques to work with that?
Well, I would go with, you know, what you're naturally inclined toward, you know, that choiceless awareness, and just have the breath be one of those things. And maybe, you know, maybe a slight preference toward feeling the breath as well as everything else.
Right.
And also noticing the part of you that gets controlling, that wants to do it right.
Right. And I guess that's where my issue lies, because even when I try to make it kind of a smaller part of this entirety with the other objects that are present, there's still that stress around the breath if it's present there regardless.
Yeah, I would just kind of take a not worry about it for a while. Yeah, you know, spend some time, maybe a few years, just hanging out in the choiceless awareness and see if that does it kind of unwind by itself.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you.
You bet. Okay, we have one more up here. I offered to answer your questions, so let's do that. And if you have to leave, then go ahead, but we'll be a minute or two late.
Thank you. My question is about how you've mentioned there are many different approaches or techniques to employ for, I'm assuming, like any given moment, like whatever would be most beneficial. And I'm wondering how best to do that without thinking too hard about it.
Yeah.
And with recognizing when you like get it, quote, like right, like what that might feel like, or how do you know you've done the right approach?
Well, what I would suggest, it's like learning anything, any skill, there's lots of, you know, particulars you have to kind of cultivate or practice. Just pick like one of those and just say, okay, I'm going to practice, you know, shifting to a broader field when I start to get distracted, right? And still kind of keeping an eye on that. For example, you know, you can pick any one of them and practice it for, you know, a few days or a few weeks till you kind of feel like you understand it more fully. And when you're more concentrated, there's just a natural sense of the attention is kind of resting in this experience. So it might look like you're feeling like, let's say you're focusing on the breath or sensation or sound or whatever it might be, or choiceless awareness. There's a sense of steadiness that's more sustained over a little bit of time. Right? It doesn't mean it's going to be perfect, but like there's maybe like instead of being every in-breath you get lost, you know, it's like maybe it's a few breaths before you get lost, for example. So there's a kind of that growing of that cultivation. There's a sense of steadiness that's coming in. There's also a sense of the body and mind becoming more interconnected, more unified.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Thank you for all your questions. If you have anything else that you didn't have a chance, you're welcome to pop up afterwards. All right. Thank you all. Nice to see you. May you have a wonderful summer and safe evening. Thank you all online. Nice to have you all here.